piece we're going to have is the Aura Multisensory Conflict by Daniela Casquella and Salome Voglin. So since 2013, Daniela and Salome have been pursuing a public deliberation of listening and writing on London's Resonance 104.4 FM. The monthly broadcasts of Aura voyages into listening and writing each address a particular issue that focuses conversations around sound art and sonic practices. Themes such as voice and language, ethics, quietude, fiction have offered their specific context to reimagine the theorization of sound. Between lecture and performance, Casquella and Voglin practice and scrutinize a number of research materials. They improvise sounds and texts that do not explain or interpret, but embody rhythms, repetitions, coincidences, and discordancies to represent aesthetic, poetic, political conflicts. More recently, Aura has morphed into an improvisational format in public performances, creating a sound work that faces its own meta-discourse and is able to talk back, infusing stable frameworks of theory and criticism with the vagaries of invisible sound.
This is Aura 23, Multisensory Conflict, an adaptation of a performance by myself, Daniela Casquella, and Salome Voglin, held at Queen's College, Cambridge, as part of the Sound Studies Art Experience Politics Conference at the Centre for Research in the Arts, Social Sciences and Humanities, University of Cambridge, 9th of July 2015.
Colonel Jack Hamilton and I would walk down in the direction of San Ferdinando, elbowing our way through the unruly mob which thronged Via Toledo from dawn until curfew time. We were clean, tidy, and well-fed, Jack and I, as we made our way through the midst of the dreadful Neapolitan mob, squalid, dirty, starving, ragged, jostled, and insulted in all the languages and dialects of the world, by troops of soldiers belonging to the armies of liberation, which were drawn from all the races of the earth. The distinction of being the first among all the peoples of Europe to be liberated had fallen to the people of Naples. And in celebration of the winning of so well-deserved a prize, my poor beloved Neapolitans, after 3 years of hunger, epidemics, and savage air attacks, had accepted gracefully and patriotically the longed-for and coveted honor of playing the part of a conquered people, of singing, clapping, jumping for joy amid the ruins of their houses, unfurling foreign flags, which until the day before had been the emblems of their foes, and throwing flowers from their windows onto the heads of the conquerors. Dawn was already breaking, and a light green mist was forming on the skin of the mourners' faces, on the plaster of the walls, and on the grey blanket of the sky, in which gaps had been torn here and there by the bitter wind of early morning. And through the rents, a pinkness was visible, like a new flesh that forms over a wound. The crowd continued to wait in the courtyard, praying aloud, and every so often interrupting its prayers to give expression to its grief. At about 10 in the morning, pandemonium broke loose. Weary of the long wait, impatient to have news of their dear ones, to know if they were really dead or if there was any hope of saving them, and fearful of being betrayed by doctors and orderlies, the crowd began yelling, cursing, and hurling stones against the window panes. And finally, by sheer weight of numbers, they broke open the doors. As soon as the heavy portals yielded the deafening, ferocious clamor died down as if by magic, and silently, like a pack of wolves, panting, gritting their teeth, every so often peering through doorways, running with lowered heads through the passages of the ancient buildings, made fetid and filthy by time and neglect, the crowd invaded the hospital. But having reached the entrance to the cloister, from which dark corridors radiated in every direction, they burst into a terrible cry and halted, petrified with horror. On the floors, piled up on heaps of garbage, blood-stained garments and damp straw, lay hundreds and hundreds of disfigured corpses, their heads enormous, swollen through suffocation in blue, green and purple in color, their face crushed, their limbs truncated or torn right off by the violence of the explosions. In a corner of the cloister stood a pyramid of heads with wide-open eyes and gaping mouths. With loud cries, frantic wails, and savage laments, the crowd threw themselves on the dead, calling them by name in voices that were terrible to hear, fighting for possession of those headless trunks, those torn limbs, those severed heads, those miserable remains which deluded pity and love seemed to recognize.
Our black door has a white X. Next door but one has a white X. 59, 64, 65, 62, 68, and fresh this morning, 58. The curly-headed twins just turned 4. Our white X and our black door seems bigger than 64. Two of us are blighted. When I come home, the first thing I see is the white X. I can't help myself once I have looked. I can't stop even inside with all the terrible breathing and the smell of the terrible breathing. Even inside, I still see X. Last night, the shape of it falling asleep. I don't sleep deep now. I sleep the sleep of the dying companion, fitful, fearful, strange, sudden, still moment, long, empty moment, and the loud, breathless breathing. I see X. It is the sign of the devil. I pray for the breathing to stop. I get up and watch my shrunken sons. Outside, the canny moon is hopeful. Tonight, let them both go in one fell swoop and let me get that X off. I've seen them come late with the black paint.
Thank you.
The winter outfit consisted of a jacket, a pair of trousers, a cap, and an overcoat of woolen cloth in broad stripes, plus a shirt, a pair of cotton underpants and a pair of foot cloths, a pullover, and a pair of boots with wooden soles. By the month of April, when the cold, though less severe, had not yet gone, the thick clothing pullovers would be withdrawn and trousers and jackets replaced by similar articles in cotton, also with broad stripes. And only towards the end of October would the winter garments be distributed again. Having spare clothes or underwear was strictly forbidden, so it was practically impossible to wash shirts or underpants. These items were officially changed at intervals of 30, 40, or 50 days, depending on availability, without the possibility of choice. The new underwear was not actually clean, of course, but simply disinfected by steam because there was no laundry. It usually consisted of short cotton underpants and of shirts, always cotton or some other thin cloth, often without sleeves. Always a disgusting appearance because of the many stains of all kinds and often reduced to rags. Sometimes instead one would be given the jacket or trousers from a pair of pyjamas or even some article of female underwear. The repeated disinfections weakened the fibres of the cloth, removing all resistance to wear and tear. All these materials represented the shoddiest part of the linen seized.
After the end of the world, one and one, 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 one and two, one and two and no more, one and two, one and two, no more, one and two, one and two, no more, one and two, one two and, one two and, one two and. 1, 2, and 1, 2, and 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, on, candor, honor, candor, honor, candor, honor. Can do one more, 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 can murmur, murder, mirth, can murmur, murder, mirth, can murmur, murder, mirth, can murmur, murder, mirth. This is a saying, one. Can murder mention one? This is a saying. Stop. Not it. Can it is. Can it is. Can it is. The hat on the steps of. The window pane is by now. The sea flow scaffold for the sheep. I came come of the being. Androgynous struggles. 2 and 3 and 5. 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 Accent her. Hand armors of wonder. The manner of stove, an instance of romance, or form, 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 or form. And land, and land, and land, and land, and land, and land. And scape, escape, romance, 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 and
of this world, all things twice over, the strong clock justifies beating our horses. You plant into your deepest part, climb out of yourself forever. Unlesbarkeit dieser Welt, alles doppelt. Die starken Uhren geben der Schwallstunde recht. Heiser, du in dein tiefstes geklemmt, entsteigst dir für immer. Eligibility of this world, all things twice over, the strong clocks justify the splitting hour. Falsely, you clamped into your deepest part, climb out of yourself, forever. Unlesbarkeit dieser Welt, alles doppelt, die starken Uhren geben der Spaltstunde recht heiser. Du in dein tiefstes Gehirn schweißt dir für immer. Eligibility. This world. Strong clocks. Hoarsely. Clamp. Deepen. Climb out. Unlesbarkeit. Thank you. live in thorns like a flower. Like the butterfly, I live in flames. If anyone asks about me, I'm an Afghan living in the valleys. I don't like anybody else's palaces. I'm the son of Afghans. I live in a tent. When I see the country's wounds, I start screaming inside. I will always care about my country. What happened to Afghans? I live in thought. The enemy came and became our boss today. My country was destroyed. I live in ruins. My country cries aloud here. That's why I live in grief once again. Is there anyone who will wash away my tears? I am Kabul, living in red flames. Light has left my homeland. I'm falling in every direction. I live in the dark. I'm Vatanyar. I'm mourning for my country. I'm awake each night until dawn.
I've been haunted by a poem, apparently as simple as a ballad and with a ballad's appeal of timelessness. It's by Elizabeth Bishop, a white North American with middle-class roots. Orphaned and deracinated as a child, she grew up as a lesbian, a traveler exile, living a significant part of her life in Brazil. She's not thought of as a political poet by most people who admire her. She's most often praised as a poet of minute observation and description. The poem is called Chemin de Fer. Alone on the railroad track, I walked with pounding heart. The ties were too close together, or maybe too far apart. The scenery was impoverished. Scrub pine and oak, beyond its mingled gray-green foliage, I saw the little pond where the dirty hermit lives, lying like an old tear, holding on to its injuries lucidly year after year. The hermit shot off his shotgun and the tree by his cabin shook. Over the pond went a ripple, the pet hen went chook chook. Love should be put into action, screamed the old hermit. Across the pond an echo tried and tried to confirm it. Love might be put into action by firing a gun, yes. At whom? In what extremity? The gun in this poem, like a real gun, might be fired out of despair and love's inaction, passivity, inertness, abuses, neglect. It's a dirty hermit who fires the shotgun and nothing in particular, who screams at no one in particular the ethical imperative love should be put into action. Someone long isolate outside community who, like the pond, has been holding on into his injuries lucidly year after year. And who is the other character in the poem, the narrator of all this? Someone alone, whose heart is pounding, walking the road of iron, the railroad track, the hobo track, a child trying to run away from home, turned out from home. Someone, in any case, who still hasn't gotten far from home, who has known this landscape year after year. Someone needing to get far away, someone whose eyes have seen perhaps destruction of community, preventable disintegration, a child of lost immigration, passive neglect, intrafamiliar violations. Someone not yet, but potentially a hobo or a dirty hermit, or someone who's legion across the globe, for whom the hermit's scream, the shout of the shotgun, might be relief in a scene of enormous, unnameable tension and impoverishment. But there is nothing lonelier sounding or more futile than an echo, and the poem ends with this.
The thoughts of Chairman Tittmeyer. I don't want to be here to put the cultural icing on the cake, The breaking of the bonds of social integration, which culture is asked to reconstruct, is the direct consequence of a policy, an economic policy. And sociologists are often asked to repair economists' breakages. So instead of merely offering what in hospitals is called palliative treatment, I would like to raise the question of the doctor's contribution to the disease. For it might be that to a large extent the social diseases that we deplore are produced by the often brutal medicine given to those who are supposed to be cured. To do so, having read in the aeroplane which took me from Athens to Zurich for an interview with the president of the Bundesbank, who is presented as the high priest of the Deutschmark, neither more nor less, and since I'm in a center renowned for its traditions of literary exegesis, I would like to perform a kind of hermeneutic analysis of a text, which you will find in full in Le Monde of 17th October 1996. This is what the high priest of the Deutschmark says. The crucial issue today is to create a condition favorable to lasting growth and the confidence of investors. It is therefore necessary to restrain public spending. In other words, he's more explicit in the following sentences: to bury as quickly as possible the welfare state and its expensive social and cultural policies, so as to reassure investors who will prefer to take charge of their own cultural investments. I am sure that they all enjoy romantic music and expressionist paintings, and while I know nothing of the taste of the president of the Bundesbank, I can well believe that, like the governor of the Banque de France, Mr. Trichet, he reads poetry and sponsors the arts.
Millennium, Part 1, Jihad. When two set out to dine or duel together, a third appears. Tertium quid, parasite, witness, prophet, escapee. 5 years ago, it still remained possible to occupy a third position in the world, a neither-nor of refusal or slyness, a realm outside the dialectic, even a space of withdrawal. Disappearance as will to power. But now there's only one world, triumphant end of history, end of the unbearable pain of imagination, actually an apotheosis of cybernetic social Darwinism. Money decrees itself a law of nature and demands absolute liberty, completely spiritualized, freed from its outworn body, mere production. Circulating toward infinity and instantaneity in a Gnostic numosphere far above Earth, money alone will define consciousness. The 20th century ended 5 years ago. This is the millennium. Where there is no second, no opposition, there can be no third, no neither nor. So the choice remains. Either we accept ourselves as the last humans, or else we accept ourselves as the opposition, either auto-monotony or autonomy. All positions of withdrawal must be considered from a point of view based on new strategic demands. In a sense, we're cornered. As the old-time ideologues would have said, our situation is objectively pre-revolutionary again. Beyond the temporary autonomous zone, beyond the insurrection, there is the necessary revolution, the jihad. 2. Sameness. 21st century money is a chaos, while 20th century ideology was merely an entropy. Both bourgeois and anti-bourgeois thought proposed a single world, unified in consciousness by science. But money alone will actually achieve that world. Money is not migratory, for the nomad moves from place to place while money moves from time to time, obliterating space. Money is not a rhizome, but a chaos, an interdimensionality, inorganic but reproductive, infinite regressive bifurcation, the sexuality of the dead. Capital must be considered a strange attractor. Perhaps the very mathematics of this money, out of control, could already be traced in such esoteric webs as SWIFT, the private internet for banks and arbitrage houses, where $2-3 trillion a day disports itself in cyberspace, and less than 5% of it refers even obliquely to actual production. The one world can deal with chaos, but it reduces all true complexity to sameness and separation. Consciousness itself enters into representation. Lived experience, which demands presence, must be denied, lest it threaten to constitute another world. In a heaven of imagery, there persists only the afterlife of the swing, the Gnostic star, the grass of disappointment. Infinitely the same. Infinitely connected, immeasurable identity of desire, immeasurable distance. One world cannot average pleasure itself, but only its of the one world and its sham carnality, opposition proposes a gnosis of its own, a dialogics of presence, the pleasure of overcoming the representation of pleasure, a kind of touchstone. Not censorship, not management of the image, but the reverse.
Thank you. il silenzio del rumore delle valvole a pressione, i cilindri del calore, serbatoi di produzione, anche il tuo spazio è su misura. Non hai forza per tentare di cambiare il tuo avvenire, per paura di scoprire libertà che non vuoi avere. Ti sei mai chiesto quale funzione hai? Quale funzione hai? Ti sei mai chiesto per paura di scoprire?
Sat down to read Foucault with pencil in hand, knocked over a glass of water onto waiting room floor, put down Foucault and pencil, mopped up water, refilled glass. Sat down to read Foucault with pencil in hand, stopped to write note in notebook, took up Foucault with pencil in hand. Counselor beckoned from doorway, put away Foucault and pencil as well as notebook and pen. Sat with counselor discussing situation fraught with conflict taking form of many heated arguments. Counselor pointed to danger, raised red flag. Left counselor, went to subway. Sat in subway car, took out Foucault and pencil but did not read, thought instead about situation fraught with conflict, red flag, recent argument concerning travel. Argument itself became form of travel. Each sentence carrying arguers on to next sentence on to next, and in the end, arguers were not where they had started, were also tired from travelling and spending so long face to face in each other's company. After several stations on subway thinking about argument, stopped thinking and opened Foucault. Found Foucault in French hard to understand. Short sentences easier to understand than long ones. Certain long ones understandable part by part, but so long, forgot beginning before reaching end. Went back to beginning, understood beginning, read on, and again forgot beginning before reaching end. Read on without going back and without understanding, without remembering and without learning, pencil, hide. Read on without going back and without understanding, without remembering and without learning, pencil, idle in hand. Came to sentence that was clear, made pencil mark in margin. Mark indicated understanding, indicated forward progress in book. Lifted eyes from Foucault, looked at other passengers. Took out notebook and pen to make note about passengers. Made accidental mark with pencil in margin of Foucault. Put down notebook, erased mark. Returned thoughts to argument. Argument not only like vehicle, carried arguers forward, but also like plant, grew like hedge, surrounding arguers at first thinly, some light coming through, then more thickly, keeping light out or darkening light. By argument's end, arguers could not leave hedge, could not leave each other, and light was dim. Thought of question to ask about argument, took out notebook and pen and wrote down. Put away notebook and returned to Foucault. Understood more clearly at which points Foucault harder to understand and at which points easier. Harder to understand when sentence was long and noun identifying subject of sentence was left back at beginning, replaced by male or female pronoun, when forgot what noun pronoun replaced and had only pronoun for company travelling through sentence. Sometimes pronoun then giving way in mid-sentence to new noun in turn replaced by new pronoun, which then continued on to end of sentence. Also, harder to understand when subject of sentence was noun, like thought, absence, law. Easier to understand when subject was noun, like beach, wave, sand, sanatorium, pension, door, hallway, or civil servant. Before and after sentence about sand, civil servant, or pension, however, came sentence about attraction, neglect, emptiness, absence, or law, so parts of book understood were separated by parts not understood. put down Foucault and pencil, took out notebook and made note of what was now at least understood about lack of understanding reading Foucault, looked up at other passengers, thought again about argument, made note of same question about argument as before, though with stress on different word.
Yes, that was 1960. A woeful year, my friend. A venomous maggot began to infest the robust and succulent fruit of our empire, and everything took such a morbid and irreparable course that instead of juice, alas, the fruit oozed blood. Let the flags fly at half mast and our heads droop sorrowfully. Let us lay our hands upon our hearts. Today we know that it was already the beginning of the end, and that what came next was irreversibly fated. It was then serving his most sublime majesty as an officer in the Ministry of Ceremonies, Department of Processions, in only 5 years of zealous and unblemished service, I bore so many tribulations that every hair on my head turned white. This happened because each time our monarch was to go abroad to leave Addis Ababa to honor some province with his presence, savage competition broke out in the palace for places in the traveling imperial party. There were two rounds in this struggle. During the first, all our notables contended to be part of the imperial party. In the second round, those who had triumphed in the preliminary stage strove to high and honorable places in the party. We officers at the very head of the procession, its first ranks, weren't involved in the struggle, since His Benevolent Highness chose those ranks himself, and an imperial assistant passed his decrees to us by way of the Master of the Palace Ceremonies. At the top of the list stood members of the royal family, the Crown Council, and luminaries that His Ineffable Highness had decided to keep within his royal view, because he suspected that in his absence they might foment a conspiracy in the capital, nor had we any problems defining the servants of the party. Bodyguards, cooks, pillow bearers, valets, purse bearers, gift bearers, dog keepers, throne bearers, lackeys, and maids. But between the top and the bottom of the list yawned an emptiness into which the favourites and the courtiers tried to insinuate themselves. We ceremonial officers lived as if suspended between two great millstones, waiting for one of them to crush us. It was we who had to compile the list and send it on to our superiors. On us the crowd of favourites descended, attacking first with pleas, then with threats, First with laments and then with solemn vows of revenge. One asked for mercy, while another proffered bribes. One promised heaps of gold, while the next threatened to submit an informer's report about us. Patrons of the favorites dunned us constantly, and each recommended putting his chosen one on the list, backing up his words and threats. Yet who could blame these patrons? They themselves acted under pressure. All the while, their underlings were making demands, and they themselves were jostling each other. For what a disgrace it would be for the patron who filed if another patron managed to place his favorite. Yes, the millstones began to turn, and these ceremonial officers watched our hair turn white. Any one of these mighty patrons could crush us to a pulp. But was it our fault if the whole empire could not fit into the traveling party? And when everyone possible had been squeezed in, and the list determined, pushing and undermining and elbowing began anew. Those who were lower were determined to rise. Number 43 wanted to be 26. 78 had an eye on 32th place. 57 climbed to 29. 67 went straight to 34. 41 pushed 30 out of the way. 26 was short. 54 63 scratched his way to 49 and always upward toward the top without end.
Oh.